welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie, senior fellow here at Bruegel, and I am very excited to be having this discussion today about the future of the global fight against climate change and to keep our planet a livable place. We are incredibly honored to have Laurence Tubiana, who is the CEO of the European Climate Foundation and has been instrumental in the Paris process so far, the Paris Accords. We are also joined by a couple of Bruegel scholars, Elisa Kleinienhaus and Jean Pisani-Ferry, who will be speaking about their research and about the state of the world. And with that, Laurence, we just had another round of the COP conferences, these UN conferences to bring everybody together and come up with a plan. There's not a great plan. The world is not becoming a more stable and more predictable place. Where are we and where are we going?
Taking stock of what has happened in Baku after a number of COPs and thinking about what is the next goal of finance that has to be defined for the years to come after 2025, which is normally where the actual negotiation will land this year in Belém. Initially, we were in climate finance on a sort of very limited idea that was put forward in Copenhagen 2009, saying that developed countries should transfer $100 billion a year to developing countries, and was a mix of public and private finance. This was until 2020. This commitment had been extended through to 2025. And now, of course, the idea is to know what's next. And what's next is the negotiation today. Interestingly enough, there was a lot of work done, in particular because a particular international high-level group that was led by Lord Stern, Amar Bhattacharya, and Vera Songwe, three economies that have been very dedicated on climate, just to try to assess what kind of finance we need to do the transition. And I must say, initially, this group, which I participated in, was basically interested in mitigation costs, the transition, the cost of the energy transition, of the agriculture sector being, of course, not emitting, but potentially even storing climate. So this has led to an evaluation of the money we need. And this evaluation is that we need at least $2 to $3 trillion a year for developing countries, mostly emerging countries, excluding China, that they will need that money to invest in the transition. And from this assessment, the additional layer has to come from, there is a part, around $2 trillion a year, that has to be mobilization of domestic resources. And then there is another $1.3 trillion that has encompassed all sorts of financing that should come from the international field, whether it is multilateral development banks, air transfer from developing countries, or private capital globally. So that now there is an agreement that this is a number we are looking on the mobilization of international money to go to developing countries to support the transition. Then now, of course, the question is how we mobilize this money, given the fact that there is at least a compromise to have until 2035, $300 billion in a way, in the classical more way of a transfer from developed countries to developing ones. And the rest will be more a mobilization of private capital. At least that's what is implied by these numbers. So now from here, from now to the end of the COP, meaning in next November, there is a process to try to define what kind of sources, what kind of reform of the World Bank, and then progressively, and because unfortunately the cost of climate change, the impact, have been grown enormously, that now we need to consider how we compensate the countries that finally have faced enormous damages given to extreme weather events, and in particular the small island. But that almost every week, we see a particular event that is really an enormous problem for many countries, in particular in the developing world. So that's the scene. The scene is a compromise by government to try to raise from this $100 billion to $300 billion annually. But then to be really serious on the international financial system globally, to raise $1.3 trillion that could support the domestic mobilization that is needed anyway in developing countries.
Yeah, that's a really wonderful overview of just where we stand. 1.3 trillion is a tremendous amount to raise from any source. Just briefly, how will this look with a very uncooperative United States?
So that, of course, the shock we are still living. I think we have not absorbed totally what finally President Trump has decided already, because that's not even a future. So the first level, of course, is a withdrawal from the Paris Agreement of US. So it was expected. So this is not a surprise. The rapid, very rapid decision to withdraw any foreign aid is certainly something which I think nobody anticipates so quickly. So now, of course, already since, of course, 2017, US had been lagging behind in the contribution of the 100 billion, even if the Biden administration has, in a way, compensated some during these 4 years of this mandate. But now, again, who will compensate for US? Who will be, can Europe comes up? Probably and very unlikely. Can other countries like Canada, Australia, Japan, or other G7 country can compensate? I don't think it will happen. So we have a big issue about how you fill the gap that US is finally creating. Then, of course, there was a whole question about the reform of the multilateral development banks with two ideas. One was we increase the capital, so to allow the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank, all the regional international institutions to increase their capital to be able to lend more and with more concessionality to developing countries. And this, again, given the role of United States and their, of course, administrators in the international system, including, of course, IMF and World Bank and others, it's a question mark. Will finally Trump administration let the pro-climate orientation that has been decided during the last 4 years, the ideas that MDBs can lend more and working on their balance sheet, meaning taking a little bit more risk, which is totally an open question. And even some are worried about the decision, the very rapid decision that US can take about their representative in these boards of the international institution.
Thank you for that. Elisa, you've been working hard to make the cost of climate change visible. It can be very hard for people in the financial sector to set a currency price on this in the same way that they can for other financial characteristics. Tell us about what you're working on and how it could make a difference.
Thank you so much. Very pleased to be here. Yeah, so I'm happy to answer that and also build on the answers that Laurence has very insightfully given. So I've been working with Jermyn Zettelmeyer and Patrick Bolton on a paper called The Economic Case for Climate Finance at Scale. And I guess I can tie this into one of the answers of Laurence, where she, said that in 2009, the promise was offered to give 100 billion a year to developing countries to help them with mitigation and adaptation. Already, as part of the first climate agreement, the UNFCCC, there has been this principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, where sort of the expectation is that all need to go to net zero, but developed countries take the lead in making that happen, both with respect to how ambitious they are on their NDCs, but also helping developing countries get there. And so that's where that 100 billion comes from. And that was also, as Lawrence knows, of course, very well, taken up as part of the Paris Agreement, where indeed it was already in the annex of that agreement that before 2025, a new quantified goal of climate finance would be agreed. Now, it was always hard to get to that 100 billion a year. And it was met late in 2022 after some retweaking of accounting definitions. And I think that is in part because climate finance has often been framed as a moral obligation or an equitable act, which it certainly is. And that's, how it has been framed in these agreements. But what we show in our work is that climate finance is not just equitable from developed to developing countries and not just a moral obligation, but it's also very much in their economic interest. So what we basically ask in this work, as well as the earlier work called the Great Carbon Arbitrage, is what is the cost and what are the benefits of transitioning? So we're focusing primarily here on mitigation to a low or net zero economy. And so if you're wondering, you know, let's say you want to decarbonize Indonesia, right? What are the costs? Well, it's the cost to close fossil fuels early. And then it's the cost to build renewables in its place so that you don't have a shortage of energy. So just to, you know, get one more thing clear, the climate crisis, of course, very much a fossil fuel crisis. So basically the climate finance ought to consist of the, you know, the cost to phase out fossil fuels and the cost to phase in renewables in its place. And so it turns out that if you compensate for early fossil fuel closure and you're able to pay for the part of the renewables that is necessary to crowd in private capital, that for developed countries, that those costs, even if they had to decarbonize all emerging and developing market economies, excluding China, is far, far smaller than the benefits that they would reap in terms of avoided climate loss and damages at home and avoided adaptation costs, which, as Lawrence has all said, are already starting to escalate. And of course, climate damage are felt everywhere, also in developed countries. So it's also in their interest, developing countries, also in their interest. But in this paper, we're focusing primarily on the benefits to those that are the financiers, because we realize that, you know, many are willing to give some amount for charity, but not trillions. So if you, as William Nordhaus says, you know, if you have a $1 trillion climate crisis, you need a robust incentive structure. And, you know, the final thing I'll say, and then I'd love to, in the next answer, tell also a bit more about this NCQG that Lawrence has talked about, but let me, you know, stop with my initial answer here. I just want to point out one thing, which is that if you look at the recent climate events that have happened in developed countries, like Hurricane Helene, and I've got the second name, the second hurricane as well hitting the US, as well as the floods in Valencia, the wildfires in LA. You know, these two hurricanes have, by some science paper, been estimated to be maybe $300 billion in losses. LA is also on the order of hundreds of billions, even maybe a trillion. And Valencia was also huge losses. So this is already at least five times more than what currently is being offered to developing countries, right? And you can easily see that this is 2025, and that imbalance will grow more if we're not willing to now pay what it takes to help mitigate emissions in these countries, because the truth is that most of the emissions in the 21st century are going to come from emerging and developing market economies. And so even if, which is already an if, developed countries would reach net zero in time, they will still be headed for climate disaster unless they can bring these countries on board.
So Jean, you have long been the voice of realism on these issues for European governments that haven't wanted to quite grapple with the cost. What do you make of it all?
We've learned, I mean, clearly that the cost of climate change mitigation in developing countries is significantly higher than the cost of the investment in advanced economies. And the cost of capital is also significantly higher. It's, you know, if you take a sample of emerging countries, exclude China, and then look at what the cost of capital, it's probably twice higher than the cost of capital in advanced economies. That's a major challenge, because investment costs and the cost of capital are both way higher than in advanced economies. Why is it so? Why is it that these costs are so much higher? Essentially because investments, decarbonization investments, are capital intensive. So it requires changing a gas turbine into a solar farm or plus the network cost. And if you look at the detail, and that's true in whichever country, the costs of decarbonization are much higher. And so the question is the affordability for developing countries. Now, the next point is, what about the cost of inaction? And I think what we've learned also in recent years is that the cost of inaction has been massively underestimated. So the cost of, business as usual, as a way to not doing anything and continuing on the same path, we're learning from more detailed studies that these costs are something like 20-25% of GDP by 2100. So it's major, and it's major for the world, and it's major especially for developing countries, because they are more subject to climate change, and they're more vulnerable to what happens. The cost of action is high. The cost of inaction is way higher. And then the question is, how can a coalition of countries find a way to finance this investment in developing and emerging countries? And what makes this coalition large enough to break the deadlock and to be able to afford the cost? And if you look at that, clearly the cost of action is high, but the fact that the cost of inaction has increased so much more and has become so much higher in comparison to the cost of action also means that the coalition doesn't need to be universal and can be smaller. So with a smaller coalition, it's a self-interest of advanced countries to pay for the decarbonization of the South. Now, then the question becomes the one of how to ensure that this decarbonization is actually implemented, how to monitor, what is the type of conditionality that goes with it. And so that's where this line of research that was undertaken by Alyssa is so important, because it suggests that their actual efforts that can be made, and that they compared to the business as usual, it's in the self-interest of advanced countries and even of a limited coalition of advanced countries to finance this investment in the South.
Thanks so much for that. As we head into the next section of the podcast, I'd like to talk more about the role of multilateral institutions. Laurence, you talked about World Bank reform as one of the necessary components of finding the money. Is that essential to get agreement in the next year on this timeline? Does the World Bank need to have a path for how it's going to move forward also?
As we just hear from Alicia and Jean, we don't need everybody to participate to that effort, but we have to recognize, given in particular the fiscal situation of developing countries, and in particular the very high debt, which has been, of course, a result of COVID, of high price on the, they have really borrowed at high price on the market, in particular vis-a-vis private sector and vis-a-vis China. So they are, some of them are in a very big debt trap. So what is the solution for a debt trap? You have, of course, partly the one who can offer debt relief, but now it's not really a lot of G7 countries that has, in a way, a capacity to do so. So it's mainly a discussion with China and the multilateral institution that can help. So that's why, for the first element, the MDBs are important. And because when you look at what happened with the 100 billion Alicia was referring to, finally, a big part of it has been out of multilateral institutions and their capacity, very low for the moment, but still existing, of leveraging private capital, offering guarantees and a sort of economic, macroeconomic stability for investors to come in emerging and developing countries. So that's why the role of MDBs are so central. The second element is they are, Jean mentioned, how we make sure that this project or this decarbonization is taking place. We must say, of course, bilateral donors can help, but it's quite difficult, no, to be on the ground, to know the financial sector of a country and to make sure that there is an enabling condition for this transition to take place. So that's why MDBs has played as a safety net for donors' activity, and more on seas is the willingness to have a coalition, a club, that of course negotiate collectively with the government, just to make sure that we have a sound project, sound funding, and sound environment. So that's why their role is so important. At the same time, they were not the more rapid, flexible, agile that we know. Of course, they are not, and that why, in a way, the reform may seems very important. But that's why I am now worried about, because that was finally, it was a very difficult discussion within the, you know, reforming the Bretton Woods institution has always been difficult. It was very difficult during the last 15 years to get there. And now we got a consensus. From now, the last 3 years have been really active consensus coming from IMF and coming from World Bank and others to say, we will lend more, we will try to leverage more capital, more private capital. So we'll do this more seriously and with a big priority on the transition and on mitigation. So this can be challenged by the boards, and that's the problem. Do we will have a very negative US participation in all these boards? They are big shareholders, so they can do a lot. And that's something which I think is a very big question mark. And I don't know the response yet. I cannot say when finally the first mandate of Trump, it was not so significant, but at that time, the World Bank has not taken the route to be much more active on mitigation on climate change. And there was finally not a clear mandate to do that. Now they got the mandate, but this mandate can be reversed by a very important and powerful shareholder. So how we can stick to that, given the fact, I don't want to be too long, so some have very good ideas and initiative recently, in particular in the domain of warranties vis-à-vis the private capital. In particular, the Inter-American Development Bank was really done interesting thing of green bonds emissions that has allowed, you know, private capital to come in and potentially eventually to, you know, really invest where it's needed. So there was a lot of very interesting financial initiative and ideas. And I am really worried about what will happen now. And so on one side, Jean is right. The cost of the damage are so huge that I can understand even California, even not thinking about US, California participating to a donor's efforts to mitigate climate change. But how the international institution we need will evolve, that is a question mark.
And tell us, if you can, how the European Climate Foundation works with the United Nations and with the UN system. Where's your role in all this?
Initially, just to give European Climate Foundation was created by the way, American philanthropists to counter, to in a way balance the narrative of climate denial, which was so dominant in the United States. Then it has evolved, in particular since I took the leadership 7 years ago now. And now, of course, it's an actor that can bridge between different actors. And we have, of course, a good finance team. And we have been working at different levels, of course, government level in EU, but as well together many other organizations to, in a way, put climate change, because that's our role, put climate change at the highest level in the political agenda. So that's why the finance element was crucial, and that's why I invest so much into, in a way, helping this discussion on reform, being, of course, working with colleagues on the assessment of the needs, combating the idea that climate, the cost of inaction were not so high because in reality we didn't know them, so it's easy to undervalue them. So all this has, in a way, made that I had really a lot of personal and my team investment in this. And of course, because now climate is, in my view, the dominant factor of what can happen at all level. We, for example, we were keen to show that inflation, in particular since 2022, was not the cost of the transition that finally, because it just unfortunately very slow to happen, but really that the food impact, the climate impacts on food in particular, and for the fossil fuel in a way, politics have really been at the core of the inflation we are facing now. So all these elements of trying to bring a new, more analytical capacity, more political attention is our job, of the day-to-day job at least. And now, of course, I don't know if you want me to develop that. It happened that because I felt that this 1.3 trillion will be very, very difficult to reach, in particular, even the 300 billion that have been decided in Baku. I launched with several countries the secretariat of a task force of global solidarity levies to try to make really the international flows that are polluting and not contributing at all to the solution to be really taxed. So, and we are now in this exercise of trying to land that by COP30, that a coalition of countries, of course, it will not be an international tax, minus maybe the case of the maritime, which take place now in international fora, that a number of countries decide to put some tax on airlines or at least air tickets or kerosene or other elements that are international flows, and try, of course, to allocate this fund to the mitigation and adaptation in developing countries.
Thanks. I want to go next to Jean just to talk about the macro side of this, how this fits with the challenges that have faced the world economy. You touched on that some in your opening remarks, and the political will necessary to do this. We have so little leadership in so many of the big, rich countries. Where do we find the will?
The EU has, has had the will to act, at least within the mandate it had received, had actually given itself. The EU is still a force for good. I think we shouldn't forget that. And in this sort of gloomy environment we're in, it's important to remember that. The question is, can the EU act alone? Can the EU build a coalition of countries willing to support the transition? Can it act, dispense of the US? And I think we have to recognize that the US, which by the way amounts for something like 11% of global emission, so the US compared to its size is a high polluter, but in absolute terms, it's not a vital player. The question, and that's the question that Laurence was asking, is can the US use its power within the Bretton Woods institutions to block the contribution of the MDBs? And here, the MDB, the World Bank, close to 50%, 45, 50% of the World Bank loans have a climate component. So it change by the US that would result from the appointment of a new executive director at the World Bank could have very severe consequences on the policy of the MDBs, because as Laurent said, it has taken time before the MDB had a mandate. We had also, a former president of the World Bank, David Malpass, who was not, to say the least, an enthusiastic of climate action and enthusiastic of climate action. So now we're in a different situation. The question is how precarious this situation is. And we haven't heard about appointments by the Trump administration at the World Bank at the IMF, but I'm worried about that.
Lisa, one of the things I love about your work is how optimistic and forward-looking and specific it is about what we can actually do. So what do you make of all this?
Thank you so much. So I've been really enjoying listening to Laurence and Sean, and I'd like to kind of build on both of their answers, I guess. And if you don't mind, I'll take one step back and then I'll come back to the coalition idea that Jean has been mentioning. So I want to step back to the very first discussion we had with Laurence on the agreement that was formed at COP29. So she indeed mentioned, right, we've in the end agreed that by 2035, public, private, and other sources would try to raise this 300 billion. And also by 2035, private and public would try to leverage this 1.3 trillion. Now, actually, he and other climate finance scholars, but also leading climate scientists such as Professor Johan Rockström, we wrote a joint statement after COP29 saying that this agreement is not aligned at all with the Paris Agreement goal of 1.5 degrees. Now, of course, the Paris Agreement has said that we should, you know, limit global warming to well below 2 degrees and aim for 1.5. But actually, the climate science is making increasingly clear that 1.5 degrees is not just an aspirational goal, but it's actually really something close to a physical limit where with every 0.1 degree above that, climate damages and the cost of climate change will increase very significantly. We may be at risk of crossing climate tipping points, including the collapse, for example, of the Atlantic Meridian, overturning circulation, which will, you know, change weather patterns worldwide. So what we have said in this paper, which was called The Economic Case for a New Quantified Goal of Climate Finance at Scale at COP29, is that what we need, and this was a sort of a parallel study, I guess, to the Turn and Songway report on climate finance, is we actually need, just for mitigation alone of developing countries, 255 billion by 2025, and use that to leverage something like 700 billion of private finance, so that indeed, and that number is quite similar to that other study, we have about 1 trillion of international finance each year. But the important part is that that climate finance needs to come now, not by 2035. And let me tell you just, you know, simply why. If we have about 190 gigatons of CO2 left in the remaining carbon budget for 1.5 degrees, we emit about 40 gigatons of CO2 every year. So if you just do a simple exercise where you say, let's assume we go to net zero linearly, you know, how quickly would we need to reach net zero? And then the answer essentially is that we need to be net zero in 2034. So we do not have the luxury to wait until 2035 to raise that money. And then the other, I would argue, problem is that the inner quantum of the public funding, the 300 billion, was really meant to be public to be able to leverage that 1.3 trillion. And now that inner quantum is not just public, which makes it much harder to reach that 1.3 trillion. So we then ask, okay, so how do we move forward from here? And so actually we have a new paper, which is not yet published, which we're writing with also Jeremy Zettelmeyer from Bruegel and Johan Rockström and Otmar Edenhofer from the PIX Institute. That's a leading climate scientist and a leading climate economist. And indeed we ask, what was the reason that COP found it so hard to come to an agreement? And I think one of the realities is that it's always very hard to agree on a global agreement when you need unanimous buy-in. At COP, the Arab negotiating group said that they would not sign on to any deal that targeted specific sectors, including the fossil fuel industry. So indeed, if you read the NCQG agreement, there is no mention of fossil fuels whatever. Whereas actually the developed country negotiators like Wopke Hoekstra and John Podesta from the US, they, I think, had read our work that it's in the economic interest, self-interest of developed countries to offer climate finance at scale if they can tie that to emission reductions, which they were not able to effectively do. So what we argue is that way forward is to not rely on a global agreement, but indeed form coalitions of the self-interested, willing developed countries that are smaller. And in this new paper, we have assessed whether it's in their economic interest still, even if the US would not be contributing at all to finance the decarbonization of all developing countries according to the original UNFCCC 1992 definition of what is developing, excluding China and other petroleum-rich states such as United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Brunei Darussalam, and Kuwait, right? So those that actually need it. Now, it turns out if you exclude China and so on, what is needed every year is, starting in 2025, is $124 billion in public grant equivalent finance, and something like $340 billion in private finance, giving about half a trillion every year. Now, it turns out that if the developed country coalition of the EU plus a few others pay for this, it's actually no more than 0.3% of their GDP, which, you know, they have some degree of high indebtedness, but that is not at all fiscally unaffordable, especially if they can also raise some of the money through a solidarity tax and so on.
So, I mean, there's a lot of numbers flying around. I appreciate having specific numbers, but I'm also struck at how many of them are on the order of magnitude of half a trillion a year or more.
I think we should take very seriously, in the coalition of willing, the assumption that China will be in some ways part of it. Why? It's just very evident that China needs the Paris Agreement to be implemented. They cannot absorb all the investment they have made in green technology if there is not strong international markets. Of course, there is a European market, but they need the emerging developing countries market to export what they have been investing in particular electric vehicles, batteries, solar panel, well, everything they have done since now 2009. And China is financing the transition as well. That's a change that took place 3 or 4 years ago. China was still funding coal power plants in many developing countries. It stopped it to do that in 2021. That was a decision of the president, Xi Jinping, to stop funding coal power plants across internationally. Now, of course, it means that, of course, we have to make choices with what finally country we work more. And that's a very delicate balance for EU, because we need China for our transition anyway, but we need China to help on the transition in other countries. And that, I think, a new model of thinking we have to develop on that, because China has the capacity still to borrow money and mostly to lend, because their saving, of course, is really, really still very high. And that's a powerful component of the strategy. So we are at crossroads in the relation with, for Europe in particular, for Japan, for Australia. The alignment with US will be on this issue impossible. So what kind of conversation we develop with China is really, really the very big question mark.
Just to complement what Laurence said, the US by itself is not, as I said before, is not a big player in climate, in emissions. So the fact that the US is withdrawing from the Paris Agreement, we can live with it. Then it raises the question, do we have a substitute? Does Europe have a substitute partner? The obvious candidate is China, and that's what you just said. And I have no doubt that's what the EU should be aiming at. Now, the question I have is, suppose the US uses its power in the Bretton Woods institution to block their role, so to turn them from being active participants in decarbonization to being neutral at best. What would it imply? And to what extent would it be a serious blow to climate action globally? And that requires knowing more, knowledge of what they do and what their actual contribution to global decarbonization.
As we move into the final section of our podcast, definitely want to come back to Jean's question. And also, if each of you, as you come around, could throw out one or two specific things that you either hope to see or really think are important, concretely and specifically, for the next year or so. Alisa.
So what we are essentially arguing is that developing countries should be submitting nationally determined contributions, which they are doing this year as an update, right? So that happens every 5 years as part of the Paris Agreement. They should be submitting conditional nationally determined contributions that are aligns with the Paris Agreement goals, ideally the 1.5-degree goal. So the conditional NDC is different than the unconditional NDC. The conditional one basically says that we will only do it if we get funding. And what we are also encouraging is that developed country coalition, and I very much agree with Lawrence and Sean that it could be a collaboration with China, should be considering to fund that transition. And what we are showing in our work is that the cost of doing that is actually fiscally affordable, and that the net economic benefits to such a funding coalition is very, very positive. So it's very much in the interest of developed countries to do what it takes, because this is really the last, you know, couple of years where saying anywhere close to 1.5 degrees is still possible, but afterwards it's not, and then we will suffer very big losses that at that point cannot be easily undone.
Certainly, we have to reconsider many, many things. In particular, as a European, we have to look at where we are, the assumption we had before, in particular the relation with US and Russia. And then can we imagine another way of, in a way, proposing to a number of emerging countries that still maybe share our values, because they are partnerships that are both trade and investment partnerships that can create a different type of discussion than the very confrontational and antagonistic discussion we are facing now. And I, for Europe, for the other countries, we see the complexity of the BRICS grouping because, of course, of the now China having introduced the group of the fossil fuel, in a way, interest in there in a very strong way. But beyond that, what kind of interest we have, Europe with South Africa, with Brazil, with Indonesia, with others, offering an alternative to the very transactional options that US is now offering. And that, for me, is the main area where we should spend our time, our intelligence, our analytical capacity to see where there is a common benefit we can create in this fragmented world, but at least that we some have some fragments that, in a way, understand the importance of global public goods, work together for them, and in a way, waiting for, I don't know, the US society to wake up on what is, how it is part finally, and it's not in Mars. We are in the Earth, and they are in the Earth as well.
Jean, I appreciated earlier how you pointed out that the European Union as a group is still very strong and committed on these issues, even as individual national governments either go through domestic crises or other wavering. How do you see Europe coming together, and how do we move forward from here?
Europe is still very much committed to the Green Deal agenda. There is some backtracking here and there. Mostly, I would say, rather innocuous at this stage, and even positive. I think the idea of simplifying the regulation and making sure that the cost of excessive regulation are not borne by the private firms and the private players, that's good. So in this regard, I'm more bullish. The question is, if it slows down, if the pace of transition slows down, at some point, it will make no sense for households to bet on decarbonization, so to buy an EV. It will make no sense to firms to continue and to get their to decarbonization or manufacturing, you know, a statement to decarbonize. You need to have some certainty about the future. If you don't have this certainty, at some point you will abandon because it's costly as you do it. So I think there's also a political tipping point in this regard, or a political economy tipping point. And I think we should be careful about that. That's my fear. Last point I wanted to make is about the structure of the Paris Agreement. What Alyssa is telling us is evidence in, you know, a number of research, in that the cost of marginal abatement cost is way higher in advanced countries than in emerging and developing countries. So it's just to mention a number. In the advanced countries, it's above $150 per ton. In India, it's below $50 per ton. That means that in a first best world, we would wish money to from advanced countries to go in priority to decarbonizing the South, instead of trying to achieve net zero at national level or at EU level. The difficulty is that this is not the logic of the Paris Agreement, and this is not the logic of the European Green Deal. So my question is, can this be changed, or can actually some reduction in the pace of decarbonization in advanced economies be traded off for faster decarbonization in the South? And I think I've caused the question that is raised in the paper by Alyssa and Patrick and other colleagues.
I think that's why it's so important not to backtrack. It's easy. It's easy. We have many voices. It's very polarized, particularly not only in Europe, but it's coming in Europe too. I hope that when we decide for Paris, when it was signed up, it was really the beginning for many countries of any decarbonization policies. Now we had 10 years after, things have advanced and investors have taken this route. Companies have invested. So I hope now the political economy is not the same than even in 2017. And you see now a number of companies now have taken that route. We see, of course, doubts in some sectors like the automotive sector, but there are many other sectors that anyway think that is the future. And because of the very strong investment of China in this sector and the capacity of funding, you see that there is a movement of the economies that go in that direction. So I hope this analysis would permeate enough that the interest of backtracking are really not supported so much by so many powerful actors. But the only problem, in a way, and I think Alyssa referred to that, is that the fossil fuel sector, one, first, has a lot of cash because of the windfall profit they gathered in 2022, and because finally they make a lot of money out of political instability, and they have regained more influence than they had before COVID, for example. So a lot of cash, a lot still of subsidies for them. So, you know, the market is not really responding to the reality. There is enormous market failure there. So that's a delicate point. And in a way, that, of course, sort of a hope that the economic sectors that have bet now on the transitions speak loudly enough that, for example, Europe doesn't backtrack. But that, of course, still a question mark.
Thank you so much. We're going to have to leave it there, but you can find all of our papers and prior events on the Bruegel website. I encourage you to go to www.bruegel.org and find Alyssa's papers, plural, some events that she's done, an event Laurence did, and Jean did with us very recently. Thank you so much to Laurence Dubiana from the European Climate Foundation for joining us today. Thank you, Jean Pisani-Ferry and Alyssa Kleinayenhaus from Bruegel. Your research and your work on this so much has been so helpful, and we really look forward to seeing what you do next. Listeners, thanks so much. This has been The Sound of Economics. I'm Rebecca Christie. See you next time.